Hello, Countless Alliance. Welcome here to church. My name is Chris. So glad that you're here for week three of our sermon series, Relatable. Just before we get into that, really exciting news on the staffing front. Just two things to update you on. The first thing is that Christine Raymer, who is a part of our staff, she's doing some stuff with communications and all that stuff. She's kind of moving into a hospitality coordinator role. And so this is a role to make sure that our weekends here are just warm and beautiful and healthy and a great culture that you want to be a part of. And so welcome on board. And that way, Cricket, Christine, she's just so good at what she does. And she's going to make this such a great place. It already is, but she's going to improve on it. So that's the first update. Second update is that we have hired a director of missional engagement. And this person is really mobilizing our church to be local here and global through our global partners, through our denomination. And so we're really excited to announce that Diane Down has stepped into that role. Many of you will know Diane. She is such a fantastic leader, respected in our community, and is a go-getter. And so she's going to come alongside, bring so much energy and focus to an area of our church that I think we really have a lot of growth to experience. And so welcome on board. If you know Diane, please reach out to her and say, give her a high five, even virtually a high five. So exciting stuff there. Hey, we are starting the second couplets in this series. The first 2 weeks were about singleness and celibacy and friendship, and now we're looking at marriage. What is it, and how do you have a good marriage? So we are going to be finishing this series with a Q&A, both in a podcast form and a panel form. If you have questions, please text in 778-860-7957. It's killing me, folks. It's killing me that I know that I won't be able to get to everything. There's so much with these topics that I just know I won't be able to cover. And so this is the opportunities where we can get into that sort of stuff. So please text in those questions. This weekend, we're going to be talking about the meaning of marriage. The first question we need to ask, though, is what is the meaning of meaning? When we ask what is the meaning of marriage, what is that going to involve? Really, there's two things I want us to think about. When we ask what is the meaning of marriage, we're asking what is the purpose of marriage? What is the underlying kind of map that marriage is? What is the intent of marriage? So regardless of who's married, what's the underlying purpose, the foundation of it that the Bible is going to give us? And so that's what we're looking at this weekend. What is the meaning of marriage? Before we talk about the meaning of marriage, let's talk a little bit about the state of marriage in Canada. In 2016, the last census that was taken, it gave us some really interesting insight on the state of marriage in Canada. One of the things is that we are learning that more people aren't getting married. Out of all the unions in Canada, 21.3% of them are in a cohabitating or common law format. So more people just aren't getting married. We're also learning that people are getting married later in life than what they used to. In 1971, the average age for marriage was in the early 20s. Now, it is in their late 20s or early 30s. So people, if they are getting married, they're getting married later. We also are seeing, and this is kind of solidifying what we already know, is that 47.5% of marriages end in divorce. And so the people who do get married, almost half of them end in divorce. The Angus Reid Institute in 2018 polled Canadians on marriage. And in this poll, 53% of the respondents affirmed the statement that marriage simply isn't necessary. So over half these people said, you know what, marriage as an institution or as a thing just isn't even necessary. This poll also found that commitment is not really an important part of romantic relationships, as only 47% of people say it's important that a couple plans to spend the rest of their lives together. So there's a sense of transience in our romantic partnerships. But this poll in 2018 by the Angus Reid Institute found that those who do get married, more than not, participate in a religious experience, a religious ceremony in order to get married. And so at the bedrock of even our country, there is a mysterious link between marriage and faith. And so what I'm going to do this weekend is I'm going to talk about what is the meaning of marriage from a Christian understanding. And so here's what we're going to do. As we go through this, we're going to see four ideas. That marriage means a new family, from me to we. Marriage means a covenant, not a contract. Marriage means adopting a ministry mindset. And finally, marriage is a profound mystery. So we're going to look at it in Genesis. We're also going to look at these texts in Ephesians. And so here we go. Let's get into it. That marriage means a new family. Now, we're going to be looking at Genesis 2, verse 24. This verse is ratified, in other words, it's talked about or affirmed both by Jesus and Paul in the New Testament. So we're going to look at Genesis 2, verse 24. But I want to get us caught up a little bit on the verses that precede Genesis 2, 24. So we're going to look at here, Genesis 2, 18 to 23. I'll go through it quickly. It said, "The Lord God said, 'It is not good. It is not good for the man to be alone.'" If you were to read Genesis 1 and 2, the refrain of God looking at his creation is, "It is good. It is good. It is good. It is good." This is the first time where he says, "It's not good." In other words, it is not good for humans to be alone, that you and I are wired for relationship. Whether that's in a spiritual family, like we talked about last week in the church, or whether it's in marriage that you and I want to be together. When you look at the most healthy people, they're always in community. Isolation is a tug, is a nudge of the curse of sin. Those who are isolated are not healthy. And this is where we get that idea. It's not good for the man to be alone. God says, "I will make a helper suitable for him." The Greek, the Hebrew word here is a Hebrew word ezer. This word is used actually of God throughout the Old Testament. Oftentimes when we think of helper, it's kind of like this degraded stance, but that's not what this word means. A helper here is somebody who supplies strength in the areas that the other is weak. That this term does not imply that the helper is stronger or weaker. That's not what God is talking about. Then it goes on. "Now the Lord God had formed out of the ground all the wild animals and the birds in the sky. He brought them to the man to see what he would name them. And whatever the man called each living creature, that was his name." This is actually called like a science called taxonomy. This is a scientific experiment here that Adam is showing dominion over the created order, this dominion that God has given him in Genesis 1. And he's naming these different animals. Now, so the man gave names to all the livestock, the birds of the sky, and the wild animals. But for Adam, no suitable helper was found. Adam's going, ostrich, emu, hippo, elephant. In other words, he's going, no, 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 no. These are not going to work for me. So then what does God do? The Lord God caused the man to fall into a deep sleep. And while he was sleeping, he took out of the man's ribs and closed up the place with flesh. This is an important moment because the rib is the significance or symbolizes that the man and the woman are from the same substance, that they are fit together, equal in their makeup, and most importantly, ladies and gentlemen, different from the elephants, right? That these humans are for each other. And that's the significance of the ribs. Then the Lord God made a woman from the rib he had taken out of the man, and he brought her to the man. Folks, this language is one of a wedding. That's what's going on. That God creates women, a woman, Eve, and he leads her to the man. This is God being the first wedding officiant. He leads her to the man. This is wedding imagery. The man said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man. Adam sees Eve and just explodes. He can't believe it, that this is the one made for me. The emu, the ostrich, the elephant, that's not going to work. But Eve, oh, she's the one for me. And he can't get over how beautiful, how perfect God's woman is. Her name is Eve. That the exclamation shows that they were meant to be together. It's their sameness and their difference that makes this union possible. Taken out of the rib, out of the same substance, but she is different than Adam. And this matters. This absolutely matters. So, here's Genesis 2:24. "That is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife. So the first idea here is a leaving, that they actually have to leave, that marriage means the starting of a new family. The man will leave the family in which he has been brought up and will go to the wife, and they will be now united as a new family unit. They left their parents as Eve comes. They left their families of origin. In a marriage, you leave your families of origin and you become one new family. This, for Genesis, is the building block of a good society. It's the building block of the world. That God in Genesis 1 and 2 doesn't set up an army. He doesn't set up a kingdom. What does he set up? He sets up marriage as the building block for the ways in which he is going to show his goodness to the world. And so this is difficult for parents, right? If you have walked your daughter down the aisle and you have seen this new family come together, there's a part of your heart that breaks. Because you are the ones who raised them and who were there when they scraped their knee. And now there's this new family coming together. So I know that that was difficult for some of you who've had to give your daughter away and see this new family be more. But here's the reality for me. I'm not going to have to go through that, because what's going to happen as I walk my girls down the aisle, the officiant's going to be up here, the doofus who's going to marry my daughter. I'm sure I'm going to like him. He's going to be okay. But he's going to ask me, who gives this woman to be married to this man? And you know what my answer is going to be? Not me. And we're going to exit out the back. I'm going to have something, and I'm going to take her away, because that's not actually happening to me. But the reality is that there's this painful process as this new family is being born. But the two individuals now go from me to we. We now get to do this together. We now get to decide, as architects of a new family, what we are leaving from our family of origin and the new people and the new family that we get to become. These people who have grown up in different circumstances, different ideologies, different traditions, different takes, different hobbies, different passions, different ways of speaking, different stories, different hang-ups, different all of these things now come together and make a new family. And this is why marriage is difficult, because these people have the opportunity and the struggle to become a new family. And so my question for all of you, regardless of the stage of life that you are at, what type of marriage have you created? As you have become a new family, what type of marriage have you created? It's a great gift to be able to do that. One of the things that we have decided, my wife and I, we have decided in our family, is we want to be a family that celebrates. We want to be a family that parties. We want to be a family where fun is at the core of who we are. And so one of the ways that we do that is on New Year's Eve, all right? The last few years have been awesome because we don't have all these invitations. We're just a family and we go all out. We go to Dollarama and we get all these neon, you know, highlight kind of things, and we put on music. We have a dance party. We have good food. Our kids drink way too much pop. That we have a dance party. We're out in the snow singing and dancing together, having a great time. And that's the opportunity that you and I have in our families to do this. And so why is this one of the things I'm talking about this weekend? Why is this important to understand the meaning of marriage? Because you have to leave something in order to start something new. And at the core of God's plan for marriage is a family unit. People in the same house doing the same things. And as Adam and Eve did this, that they would have kids, that they would be raised to know and love God, and that they would have kids to be raised and know and love God in perpetual motion. That was plan A. God didn't start with the church. He started with a family, a new family unit. And that's what marriage means. Now, we're going to go to the second idea, that marriage means a covenant and not just a contract. So the second part of this is why a man leaves his father and mother and, what does it say, is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. United and one flesh. This is about bonding. This is about these two people who are the same. They are both human, but they are different. They come together in one flesh union, a union like no other union that a human can experience, that these people bond together, the two become one. Do you remember where Eve was taken from? Out of Adam. Now in marriage, they become one again. This is the image. And so these people bond. They bond geographically. They come out of their homes and they come together. They bond physically through sex and intimacy as their bodies fit together. They bond emotionally, spiritually. They bond financially and economically, that these two people on their own journeys now, boom, they are one flesh. This is the most intimate and beautiful of all relationships that God has given to us through this beautiful thing called marriage. You see, for some of us, it's like marriage, oh man, marriage is a thing that actually steals the romance from it. It's stifling. I don't need the piece of paper to get, no, I don't want that. No. Marriage actually counterintuitively gives you the most intimacy possible. And here's why. Because both people are saying, to the exclusion of everything else and everyone else, I will pour myself into this marriage. And that commitment, the foundation of commitment, or the garden of commitment, is what makes the flowers grow. It's the commitment, the bond, the covenant that is made that actually allows the most intimacy to happen. And so we're going to talk a lot about covenant and stipulations and all that can be cold and prearranged. And it's like, I don't want that. But here's the reality. A one flesh union united is the most beautiful, intimate, and passionate arrangement you can have. And here is where we get the idea of a covenant and not a contract. That marriage means a covenant and not a contract. So, a contract, we all pretty much know what this is if you're a consumer, right? It's where my needs trump the relational realities I've entered into. So, I pay for the service, you deliver the service. You stop delivering the service, or it doesn't meet my expectations, I just move on, right? That's how a contract works. It's a consumer mindset. But a covenant is not that. A covenant is where my immediate needs fall secondarily to the covenant I have made. So more important than my immediate needs of the individual, a covenant is an ordered relationship with stipulations, with I promises, and I will do this. And the other person says, I will do this. That is what a covenant means. And so when I officiate weddings, there's a beautiful moment where they come up and they exchange vows. And I always say to couples, I say, look, we don't want to hear about your love story. Right? Oh, you're so beautiful. You know, I saw you at the other side of the room and you're wearing this beautiful jacket and it was so great. And then now, and there's this kind of this long-winded love story. Those are the worst types of vows. Why? Because it's not a covenant. Covenant is, I promise in sickness and in health, in for rich or for poor, that I will be here. That's what is being made. It's a covenant. And so what I want to do, so I want to show you a table that hopefully spells this out a little bit more. Now, what I'm not saying is that every modern marriage becomes like this, but I will say is that if a contractual, consumeristic idea is brought into a marriage, that these things, I believe, are possible in the marriage, whereas these things in a covenant happen. So let me just kind of contrast this. So a biblical idea is a covenant between partners. A modern idea of marriage is a contract. Man, it's about self-fulfillment. You stop delivering, I stop giving. In biblical marriage, there's affectionate sex. It's about mutual pleasure. It's about self-giving. In a modern marriage, it can be about self-centered sex. Well, you know what? You changed, right? I married you because you were good looking. You're not so much good looking anymore. I'm out. Or what can I get from this relationship? If you stop producing, then I'm out. That's self-centered sex. In a biblical marriage, it's about grace. It's what I promise and you promise and we're doing our best here. But in a modern marriage, it's about scorekeeping. You want to atrophy your marriage very quickly. Scorekeep. Well, I did this now. You do that, but grace, no. Grace is undeserved merit. It's favor. It's okay. I love you. We're in this together. In a biblical marriage, it's empowering. How do I see the other person flourish? In a modern marriage, it's about possessive power. It's about getting what I want on my terms. And if I have to manipulate or coerce, I will do that. In a biblical marriage, it's relationship-centered. It's about how does our relationship flourish here? Even if I have to lose, but our relationship wins, that's still a win. But in a modern marriage, it's self-centered. It's about my interests. In a biblical marriage, it's about discussion or negotiation. Hey, you know what? I'm really concerned about this part. There's an issue that I want to bring up. And what do I need to own? What am I not seeing? I feel this way. I'm thinking this way. What am I not getting? And how do I help us move forward? But man, in a modern marriage, it's demand. You better or else. There's lines drawn in the sand. Stalemates are made. Ultimatums given. And it doesn't work. The difference between a biblical marriage and the modern idea of marriage flowing from a contractual idea are very, very, very different. And this covenant is made in three different ways. Let me show you, okay? So let me draw something. It's not going to be pretty, folks, but I didn't get an art degree. Let's say this person is God, okay? And this person up here is spouse number one, and this person here is spouse number two. All right, here is the covenant that is actually made, because marriage is a three-way covenant between each other and with God. So let's think back to a marriage ceremony, right? I'm up here, giving of the bride. Bride comes up. They stand together. They all look good. Everyone's, oh, it's amazing. Pictures are taken, right? And then here's what I say. I start with a declaration of intent, and I say, is it your desire to honor, cherish for the rest of your life this other person? If it is your desire, say, I do and I will. I do and I will. And they say, I do and I will. Then I say to this person, is it your desire to be in marriage with this person, to love, cherish, and honor, serve all the days of your life? Is this your desire? Say, I do and I will. They say, I do and I will. What's going on there? They're not talking to each other yet. They're not talking to me. Who are they talking to? They are talking to God. There's a covenant being made. This is what I've chosen to do. So a declaration of intent is the link between God and this person and God and this person. This is two of the covenants, covenant one, covenant two. And then what follows a declaration of intent are the vows. And the vows are when the couple says, I promise to, for better, for worse, in sickness, in health, to death, to us part, I will be here. This is when this covenant is made between the two of them. This is the third covenant, right? First and foremost, the covenant is made between God. And then the covenant is made. Do you see how tightly wound up this relationship is? It's formal, it's beautiful, and it is forever, regardless of what you do, I will do this part. And so this is beautiful. Let me just apply this a little bit. Here's what this means. This picture, here's what it means. It means that your priority in your marriage is to honor the covenant that you have made with God. That's where marriage starts, is with God. That you, in your marriage, are to please Him because of the promise you have made to Him. That here we see that Jesus is still sufficient as He was in singleness and celibacy. It's all about God, and this is a starting point of marriage. That marriage is first about obedience to God, even when times are tough. And that may be you. You may be in a really difficult time in your marriage. When times are tough, you still have made a covenant with God. I said that I would. And in Matthew 19, Jesus says, those whom God has brought together, let no one separate. Well, what is he referencing? That this is the covenant between the first and second spouse, between them. God has brought them together. God is holding on to both of you in the marriage covenant. And that is so, so, so hopeful. When the covenant, when the promises, when the vows between you and your spouse are a mess, that God is still holding on to both of you. And this gives you immense hope. This idea here makes marriage the most intimate of all relationships, that God is a part of all of your interactions, your planning, your bonding, your one flesh union, that this is a place where man and wife express their love and service to each other in a safe, protected environment forever. This covenant, this idea promises future love. That's what a covenant is. It promises future love. It promises that, you know what, you're going to change, I'm going to change. The person that you are on this stage when you get married, you will become different people. But the covenant says, I will, in all seasons of our marriage, I will flex, I will honor, and I will cherish you all the days of my life. This is a covenant, meaning future love. And that this is a covenant where we say that it's a sacrificial commitment to the good of the other. That this means that love in this way is primarily more about action than it is feeling. Well, I don't feel like it. You know what? Covenant says, I will do this because I said I would. But here's the thing, is the more that you do, the more that you act loving, the more you'll actually feel loving. And this is the beautiful safety of a covenant. And as we think through Scripture, God is the one who gives and keeps covenants. He's a promise-keeping God. And in our marriage, we reflect that to each other. So that's the second idea. Marriage means a covenant and not a contract. Now, thirdly, marriage means adopting a ministry mindset. Now we're going to shift our focus to Ephesians 5, another great place. There's lots that I could do here, folks, but give me grace, okay? Give me grace. Here's the Ephesians 5:21 verse. It says, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. This is the verse that sets up all of the marriage talk in Ephesians chapter 5. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. And this is adopting a ministry mindset. Because Paul is saying, submit to one another. This is the command. And then here is the why. The command is submit to one another. And here's the why. Why should you do this? Out of reverence for Christ. The more that you think about Jesus, the more that you reflect on the ministry of Jesus, the more that that becomes the operational default of your heart, the more you will submit to each other. If you understand the gospel, Paul is saying, you will become submissive to the other. And when you think about the ministry of Jesus, you think about a servant. You think about somebody like in John chapter 13, where Jesus is about to go to his death, and he strips almost naked in front of his disciples. This is God in human flesh. And he sits down and he scrubs the feet of with donkey dung and dust and dirt and all of the muck and grime. And here we see Jesus serving and beautifully submitting himself, God, to clean the feet of his disciples. And in marriage, this is the starting point. What marriage means is that you become a new family, that you enter into a covenant, and that you adopt the mind of Christ, a ministry mindset. So sometimes we think about, maybe you think about, you know, man, I'm really glad, you know, Pastor Chris, Pastor Tim, all these pastors, really glad we have such a great team. I'm glad that they're doing ministry, right? They are the ones who do full-time ministry. Let me remind you, if you're married, you have said yes to being in full-time ministry to your spouse. Because this is what it's saying. In order to submit, you need to know Jesus and his servant attitude. That there's mutual submission in marriage. There's the idea that I bow to your, I give up my needs in order that you would flourish. So here is what this means. It means two things. Number one, marriage will expose you. Ah, it's true. It hurts. But it's true, my friends, that marriage is a mirror that is put up to you. And you get to see both your strengths and your deepest flaws, both the good and the bad. And marriage brings you to you. You get introduced to the real you. You see, in dating, it's like, oh, I can just show my best self. And even if you've been dating for 5 years and you've been through seasons, marriage is next level because you live together, you sleep together, you gotta fill the dishwasher together, all of these things. And you realize that marriage exposes that you are not as noble or you're as easy to live with as you first thought. And I got married and I thought, oh man, I got it all together. I got this and I got that. I'm pretty humble. And I got married and I realized, shoot, that is not a true narrative of myself, that I am extremely selfish and self-centered. And this is what marriage does. You get introduced to the real you. And what you do with that realization matters immensely. Because the more that you defend yourself, the more that you defend this perfect image of yourself that you think you are, the more your marriage will atrophy. You see, the purpose of marriage is to humble you, is for you to say, wow, I am a sinner. I don't love my neighbor or my spouse as myself. See, if you don't like to change, you won't like marriage. Because marriage is meant to refine you. It's meant to take the hard, rough edges off of you. Your anger or your impatience, your self-righteousness or your criticism. That marriage exposes you and is meant to refine you as you submit, as you learn to submit to each other. So that's the first thing it means. The second thing it means is that marriage gives you an opportunity to grow and watch the other person grow. That when you say yes to this call, to enter a ministry mindset, you get front row seats to watch the other person become who God wants them to be. And you see yourself growing more into the image of Jesus. And so there's three different types of marriages, my friends. There's three different types of marriages. The first one is a selfish person and a servant. That's an abusive marriage. That's a terrible marriage. When one person is selfish and the other person is servant, this is an unhealthy environment, not a place you want to be. The other type of marriage is to have a selfish person and another selfish person. That's when they say, you know what, I'm not going to change. You're the problem. You're the problem. No, no, no. What's the mirror telling you? That's that marriage. You know what? That becomes a manipulative marriage when they're both trying to get what they want. But the third option is for a servant and a servant to be together. When two people submit to one another out of reverence for Christ, the marriage becomes alive. Because you have one person who looks, acts, speaks like Jesus, and another person who acts, speaks, and looks like Jesus, serving each other. Life comes in that environment. So that's the good news. But the bad news is, you can't do this on your own. You can't. You can't. Because here's what's by default going to happen in your marriage. If you don't have divine power in your marriage, what's going to happen is that you're going to either go to this one or this one, unfortunately. This one, you need divine power for it. It is not in your natural state to submit to the other. But what sets up Ephesians 5, verse 21, is actually Ephesians 5, 18. And here's what Ephesians 5, 18 says, which really summarizes both before and what comes after it. Do not get drunk on wine, which leads to debauchery. Instead, be filled with the Spirit. Man, if you don't have the Spirit of God in your life, good luck in having a servant and servant marriage. Good luck adopting a ministry mindset. That you need divine power in order to have a great marriage. Because the empathy that marriage demands, being able to see something from another person's perspective, is not a natural thing for you. It's not for me. Forgiving, even when it hurts, is not natural. Dealing with disappointment in your marriage. I thought I was marrying this person, but here's a disappointment. Filtering your thoughts, your criticisms, through a lens of grace and love is difficult. It doesn't come naturally. When you enter disconnections in your marriage because of work, stress, or mental health crisis, when physically it's not working anymore, when spiritually you couldn't be different. This is not a natural thing for you to submit. Or what about when you're at old age and marriages change and sicknesses come and the spouse who you have covenanted with doesn't know your name anymore? How do you get through that? How do you keep your covenant in that moment? For some of you, I know you've sat at the side of the hospital bed with a sick child, completely disrupting all of your plans, dealing with the grief and the fear and the stress that marriages go through in that environment. How do you get through that? How do you submit to one another in that season? Paul says, you need to be filled with the Spirit. You need divine power to adopt a ministry mindset. And then finally, we're going to end with this, that marriage is a profound mystery. Why did you get married? I'm sure there's lots of great reasons. Maybe you got married to start a new family, like I talked about. Maybe you got married to make a covenant. Maybe you got married to adopt a ministry mindset. Maybe you got married because this person was a man. Why did you get married? You know, all of these three ideas are right, true, beautiful, and scriptural. But here's, I think, the main idea that kind of melds all of them or welds all of them together, is that marriage here, biblical idea of marriage, is actually at the core of what it is gospel reenactment. Gospel reenactment. And that's what Paul says in Ephesians 5. Here's what he says. Husbands, love your wives. There's the command, right? Love your wives. Now, why? Just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her with a washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. Love your wives. Why? Because as you love your wife, you are reenacting this grand story of Jesus and the church. That the love of the husband mirrors the love that Jesus has for the church. Love your wife. Why? Because Christ loved the church. This is gospel reenactment. And in this way, marriage is sacramental. Sacramental. You're like, what in the world, Chris? What does that mean? I don't mean it like perhaps a Catholic church means it when they believe that marriage is a sacrament. I don't mean it in that way. But marriage is sacramental in that it points to something else. So think about the sacraments that we practice here at KAC. Think about communion, right? I always say when we do communion, if you don't believe in Jesus, this is just a weird snack at whatever time it is, right? It's a strange snack, right? It's a cracker and really weird juice. What is this? No, it's not about the juice and the wafer. It points to something else about the death and resurrection of Jesus. Think about baptism. What's baptism? Well, you could have a bath every day of your life. You could do the exact same thing in the privacy of your own home. You get dunked, you come up, done. But hold on. When we do a baptism, we go to the river, we do it here in our church. This act of going under the water and coming up, it isn't just about the act. What does it do? It points to something else. This is a demonstration of an inward commitment to Jesus, that you are a part of his church and going to follow him the rest of your life. And then this way, marriage is sacramental. The underlying purpose and intent of marriage is to point to something else. And what is it to point to? It's to point to the love that Jesus has for the church, the love that Jesus has for you and me. So listen, more than seeing marriage as a mutual comfort, we must see it as a word picture of the most important news humans have ever received, that there is a divine relationship between God and his people. In both the Old and New Testaments, marriage is viewed as an analogy of the covenant and union of God and his people, the loving pursuit of God for you and me. And so when you see a biblical marriage, you see the gospel reenacted. Think of your wedding day as the time where you covenant together and the curtains open to the world. And as the world looks on your marriage, they should see the gospel alive as mutual submission happens, as honoring the covenant happens, as bonding happens in unity and in intimacy. This is the gospel for the world to see. And so when you see marriage, you should see the gospel being reenacted as you are selfless and self-forgetful. So how is this? Let me just spell this out. Jesus sees you and I stuck in our human condition with sin, hurts, and hang-ups, and demonstrates sacrificial love to us. He comes to us not by demanding behavior, but in dying for us. Because of this sacrifice, we are brought into relationship with Jesus and are with him towards a future glory. Our future glory selves and a future glory with him. That Jesus sees us not in our hurts and hang-ups, but still comes to us and takes us on a journey in love and in intimacy and protection towards a beautiful future. And that is the greatest love story ever told. The love that Jesus has for people like you and me in our hurts and hang-ups and addictions and insecurities. That's the greatest love story. And so if you are single, if you are not married, let me just tell you that that is the most beautiful romantic story you could ever be a part of. So I want to be clear. My friends, the purpose of your marriage is to help your spouse become his or her future glory self through sacrificial service. The modern consumeristic idea says this: I'll be the spouse I ought to be. I'll be the spouse I ought to be if and to the degree you are the spouse that you ought to be. But no. Gospel reenactment says this: I will be the spouse I ought to be whether or not you are the spouse you ought to be. Why? Because Jesus gave me spousal love like that. He loved me when I was not lovely, and I will do that for you. The heart of marriage, the meaning of it, is gospel reenactment. And in this way, marriage is meant to make you more holy than it is happy. Does it make you happy? Absolutely. But a part of marriage is a holiness of it, that you get to reenact the gospel as you flex to your spouse. My friends, if all marriages were to do this, our city would change. That's the vision of it. You see how global in its scope. You see how important this was to God in Genesis 2. This is the foundation of society. And if this is what happens in every single marriage, oh, think about how many problems would be solved. But I know when I start talking about these things, talking about the purpose of marriage and covenant and ministry mindset and intimacy and union and one flesh, for some it's beautiful and it reminds you of what you have. But for others, it's the most painful conversation that you can ever have because your marriage has ended or the marriage that you're in is a disaster. So I just want to be gracious to you. I want to be invitational to you. I want to bring hope to you as we talk about the realities of now throughout this series, the rest of the series, what that actually may look like. I want to leave you with a metaphor that I think is going to be helpful with us. And it was a metaphor that my wife and I heard in a presentation and a Q&A with Tim and Kathy Keller. Tim was a pastor in Manhattan for many years. And at the beginning of his presentation, he talked about marriage as a garden. Marriage as a garden. Let me lead you through it. He says, marriage is a garden. You start out with a seed, right? The day you get married, you start out with the seed. And in that seed is a beautiful flower. The DNA is there. Intrinsic to the seed is beauty. It will become a flower. You have to plant it. It's not like sod. Right? You don't just bring, marriage isn't like sod. You just bring it in, you lay it out, you know, you tamp it down, then you're done. No, marriage is like a seed. And you have to plant it. And you have to tend to it. In order for it to become what you want it to become, it has to be nurtured and cared for. It has to be pruned sometimes. Oh, that's not going to be necessary to its growth. You have to prune it. You have to weed around it because the weeds are going to come. You have to defend it. If there's little bugs and insects that come and start to eat it, you have to defend the flower. You have to be in the garden all the time. Even when things are looking good, you still have to be in it. It's a project that you can never give up. If you steward the garden well, oh, it's a beautiful place to be. The butterflies are coming. The bees are around. You want to come smell all of the flowers. It's beautiful. People pass by the house and say, what a beautiful garden. But the opposite is true. That maybe in your marriage, it's not a beautiful garden. It's a mess. You haven't been tending it. You've forgotten about it. There's manipulation, coercion, contractual stuff going on. And your garden, instead of being beautiful where everybody wants to be a part of it, they awe at it. Instead, it's actually filled with thorns and thistles and weeds. And it's impossible. You see, it's impossible. How do you even start to make sense of this mess? For those of you who may be there, I would say this. It's possible for the beauty to be restored. But you have to start to get to work. Start with yourself. If your spouse doesn't want to come tend the garden with you, start with yourself. Start by being the person God is asking you to be. But the promise of the garden is that with the amount of pruning and weeding and work and intention, it can be made beautiful again. And so some of your marriages are in a great season. We want to actually just pour water on that. And some of them are not. But we would say, journey with us. Journey with us. Most importantly, journey with Jesus as you're given this amazing opportunity in your sphere of influence, in your marriage, in your family, to see all of the meaning of marriage come to life in new and exciting ways. Let me pray. Lord, I just realize there's so many people tuning in who are in so many different places, single, maybe a lifelong celibate like we talked about last week. There may be people who are here and they don't know how much longer they can continue in their marriage. That what I talk about today just seems like an impossible reality. It's like I've been speaking alien to them for so long. Because for years or decades, this hasn't been their reality. Lord, I pray that you would restore the marriage. I pray for miracles, Lord. I pray for people who have been in stalemates, in demanding positions, that there would be humility, that they would adopt ministry mindsets for each other and become like Jesus to one another. Lord, for those who are dealing with the rubble of a broken marriage, I pray that you would tend to their wounds and their soul, giving grace, giving affirmation, giving community to them, bringing wholeness and health back. Oh Lord, as I bring this up, I just know there's so much here. I pray that you would be our lead pastor, pastoring these dear people, tuning in online, wherever they come from, in their moment. I trust you to do that, Jesus. In your name I pray, amen. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.